This is Lecture 5 in the series Essentials of Capitalism. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first order of business this morning is a consideration of the argument that the institution of private property and land is tainted insofar as present titles can be traced back to the violent dispossession of previous owners. This argument has its clearest application to conditions in Europe. As I pointed out in Lecture 2, in the course of the long and bloody history of that continent, probably many violent transfers of ownership can be found in connection with almost any particular piece of land. As I also indicated in Lecture 2, even on its own terms, it is doubtful that the argument has much application to the United States. For here, settlers found an almost empty continent whose relative handful of inhabitants lived by hunting, and who had few or no fixed settlements, nor, therefore, any solid basis for claiming title to the land, over which they merely roamed. And even so, the settlers frequently paid the Indian tribes for the relinquishment of their claims to rights of hunting and camping. In this sense, they purchased Manhattan Island and many other far more substantial pieces of territory from the Indian tribes. Thus, in the United States, it is true to say that the historical record of the overwhelming majority of property holdings is free from violent appropriation, that practically all property holdings can be traced back through voluntary purchases and sales to a point of peaceable appropriation from nature on the part of their very first owners. Nevertheless, the legitimacy of the institution of private property and of the title of its present owners does not in any way depend on the absence of violent appropriations of property in the past. Private property in Britain and France, for example, and the title of its present owners, is fully as legitimate as it is in the United States, despite a record of violent appropriations in the past. The reason for this is that in a division of labor society, such as Britain and France represent, there is a powerful force at work which steadily operates to wash away all stain of past violence. This is the fact that in such a society, production is carried on for the market, and that property is gained or lost in degree that one produces to the satisfaction of the market. To illustrate this principle, let us assume the existence of a society in which every piece of property has been violently seized from its previous owners. But let us also assume that from this point forward, there is an end to violent appropriation, that henceforth, such acts occur in violation of the law and are prosecuted. Thus, from this point on, property must be acquired by purchase. Now, under this new arrangement, those people will be in a position to acquire property who earn the money necessary to buy it, and who offer the greatest prospect of efficiently using the property they acquire. This second condition is a principal basis for being able to borrow money to buy property. From this point on, therefore, the basis of acquiring or retaining property becomes the ability to operate successfully in the market. Initially, of course, the power to spend in the market of this country reflects the previous seizure of property. To the extent that those who have appropriated others' property, or the heirs of the appropriators, are richer, their power to spend is greater, and production for the market is, accordingly, production that serves them. But in degree that the members of this group are not themselves as adept in producing for the market as those who have not seized property, property begins to gravitate away from the members of this group and toward the members of the second group. Soon a substantial amount of property is held not by those who have seized property or by their heirs, but by those who have supplied the wants of this group. And now their spending emerges as a growing factor in the market. As more time passes, property is increasingly held not by those who seized it or by their heirs, or even by those who supplied the wants of this group, but simply by those who are most adept at supplying the wants of others who have money to spend, who for the most part possess the same ability. In this way, the significance of the violent seizure of property in the past is steadily diminished, and all property comes to be held by those who have fully earned their right to it. How rapidly this cleansing process takes place, depends on how free the market in land is allowed to be. The main obstacle delaying the process is entail legislation, that is, laws that restrict the passage of property to a specific line of descendants, and which prohibit its sale, forfeiture and payment of debts, or even long-term lease to parties outside this line. Such legislation was enacted to preserve the holdings of aristocratic families in the face of the market forces I have just described. Of course, entail legislation is itself a gross violation of property rights. It denies the property rights of the living in the name of the alleged property rights of the unborn. The doctrine that present titles are invalid because of past acts of violence in the appropriation of property is often associated with demands for land reform. Land reform is a demand that property be forcibly transferred from its present owners to a new group of owners. The connection exists whenever this new group is alleged to be descended from earlier possessors whose rights the ancestors of the present owners allegedly violated. Let me say that no amount of past violence in the appropriation of land can justify land reform. Land reform is simply a new, fresh act of violent transfer of land. It is one thing for the actual victim of a dispossession, or his children or grandchildren, to demand to be put back in the possession of the property that was forcibly taken from him. But if, for any reason, these individuals are denied justice, it becomes a fresh injustice to later on dispossess an owner on the grounds that his ancestors, or the ancestors of some previous seller, lacked just title. In other words, for justice to be done, there must be a time limit on the recognition of claims for the redress of past injustices. If this were not the case, no one could be secure in his property. At any time, parties could step forward claiming dispossession of their ancestors by his ancestors, or by the ancestors of some previous seller of the property. And claims of any one group of alleged victims could in turn be superseded by the claims of still another group of alleged victims able to trace the dispossession of its ancestors further back. In a country like England, for example, the same piece of ground might be contended for by those able to trace the dispossession of their ancestors to the War of the Roses, or alternatively to the Norman Conquest, or to the still earlier invasions of the Danes, Saxons, Romans, and even Picts and Celts. It would certainly be a grave injustice to ask anyone to work and save to improve his property, and then take it from him on the basis of such claims. For justice to be done, conditions must be such that people can work and save to improve their property. And for such conditions to exist, property rights must be put beyond challenge as quickly and as completely as possible. This means, as a minimum, a strict time limit on the recognition of claims based on past injustices. Now, once private property rights are made secure, not only are the effects of past injustices washed away, as I have shown, but the land of a country is quickly put to its most efficient uses. It is important to realize this last point, too, in dealing with the issue of land reform. For as the advocates of land reform describe matters, the system of land ownership they seek to overthrow is highly inefficient and has no economic basis. According to them, the actual unit of agricultural production is almost always a small farm, a large share of whose output its peasant operator must turn over as rent to a wealthy landowner who has done nothing to earn it. Land reform, the forcible transfer of ownership to the peasant operators, is then urged not only as the means of rectifying past injustices, but also as the means of providing powerful incentives for the improvement of production. As owners, it is argued, the peasant operators will have the incentive to increase their production, something which they now lack because the increase would allegedly be appropriated by the wealthy landowners. What it is necessary to realize here is that if the land reformers were right in their description of the facts, a free market in land would automatically and peaceably operate to transfer ownership to the small operators. For if, as owners, the small operators would have greater incentives and would produce more, and there is no economic basis for the present large-scale ownership of land, then the present operators would have a powerful incentive to sell out to the small operators. This is because if the same piece of land, presently owned as a single unit, would produce more when subdivided into a multiple of smaller property holdings, its total market value would also be greater when subdivided into such holdings. The situation would be perfectly analogous to what happens right now in the United States as cities expand into surrounding farm or ranch land. The farmers or ranchers who own units of several hundred or several thousand acres find it profitable to subdivide and sell out their holdings in units as small as a quarter or eighth of an acre to a large number of homeowners. Well, if small units of ownership were in fact more efficient, the owners of large land holdings would have exactly the same kind of incentive to sell out to small owners. And it is worth noting that the small owners would not have to be able to pay for their purchases right away any more than home buyers need to be able to pay for their purchases right away. The small owners could buy their holdings on credit with mortgages on their property, and the arrangement would probably be advantageous to the present large owners, even if they were the ones who held the mortgages, because for 20 or 30 years they would receive far more as interest and principal payments from land used efficiently than they could otherwise receive as rent from land used inefficiently. And this excess of funds received over 20 or 30 years would more than compensate them for the loss of all future rents, in exactly the same way that receipt of a sufficiently high price in the present would more than compensate them for the loss of every subsequent year's receipts. Thus, even if the advocates of land reform were correct in their claim that the system they want to overthrow is inefficient, all that would be necessary to achieve greater efficiency is not land reform, not the forcible expropriation of property, but the establishment of a free market in land. If the more efficient system is the breakup of large land holdings into small units, then that is what a free market in land will accomplish, without force or violence, and to the mutual self-interest of all concerned. But the fact is that the breakup of large land holdings that the land reformers want to achieve by no means always represents an improvement in efficiency. Often, it is precisely the large land holdings that are the more efficient arrangement and are the product of the free market as far as it is free. This appears to be the case in the instance of large plantations producing such crops as bananas, sugar, pineapples, or coffee for export. Here the unit of production is not a farm of a few acres, but perhaps the whole plantation, or at least some substantial portion of it. The large land holding is necessary in order to utilize expensive modern equipment, like tractors, which would be uneconomical if they had to be applied within the limits of separate farms consisting of only a few acres each. In all cases of this kind, land reform represents a serious reduction in agricultural efficiency, over and above the disincentives its prospect creates for saving and any form of improvement to be undertaken by those likely to be expropriated by it. For it represents a forced reduction in the scale on which agriculture is undertaken, and thus a loss of the benefits of large-scale production. The advocates of land reform are actually oblivious to all such concerns. Their real goal is not greater efficiency in agriculture, but to enable the largest possible number of people to survive by means of subsistence farming. They want each family to be able to live by having its own few acres. And when there are more families, each will presumably have a little bit less land to farm, if not as the result of choices by bequestors of the land, then as the result of a further land reform. If we think seriously about land reform as a solution to poverty in the backward countries, it becomes clear that it is actually incompatible with the real solution. The real solution to poverty in the backward countries requires not that more people there be able to squeeze by a little bit easier as farmers, but that the populations of those countries become integrated into the international division of labor. If the people of most of Asia, Latin America, and Africa are ever to enjoy a high standard of living, it will not be as farmers on a few acres each, but as workers in the same kind of division of labor society as presently exists in the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. Thus, land reform seeks the solution to poverty in a totally wrong direction. and it actually operates to prevent the real solution from being achieved. Enforcing, for example, the breakup of large foreign-owned plantations, producing for the export market, it cuts backward countries off from such connection to the International Division of Labor as they have managed to achieve. In disrupting their exports, it deprives them of the ability to import from the more advanced countries, and thus deprives them of the ability to obtain technologically more advanced goods than they can produce for themselves. At the same time, in reducing the production of goods for export, and thus raising the prices of the goods affected, it operates to reduce the real wages of workers in the more advanced countries, since the buying power of their wages is correspondingly reduced. Even more fundamentally, the forcible restriction of the scale on which agriculture is undertaken, and the constant threat of renewed confiscations that land reform represents, operate to permanently prevent the rise in the productivity of agricultural labor that is indispensable to building a division of labor society. It should be remembered that labor can be spared for industry and commerce only in degree that it is possible for a fraction of the working population to produce the food required by the whole. Land reform operates to keep down the productivity of labor of the fraction required in agriculture, and thus to keep up the size of that fraction. It thus works to prevent the development of industry and commerce and the establishment of a division of labor society in the countries in which it exists. The solution to the agricultural problems of the backward countries is not land reform, but the establishment of a fully free market in land, and thus for the first time in those countries, the full recognition of private property rights in land. That will eliminate all vestiges of feudalism and feudal inefficiency and make possible the progressive improvement of agricultural production. Our discussion of land reform has application to current conditions in El Salvador. In that country, the government of the United States has spearheaded the drive for land reform, even under the Reagan administration. It has made land reform a precondition of American aid. While our official policy is supposed to be non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries, we clearly seem to have forgotten this policy in the case of land reform in El Salvador. We remember it, however, in connection with almost all of the nationalizations of industries, including the expropriations of our own nationals, that have occurred throughout the world. And we remember it in connection with communist atrocities. But the same State Department that helped to lose China and Cuba to communism cannot remember it in connection with land reform in El Salvador. Our press representatives in El Salvador lack the knowledge of economics required for intelligent reporting on the subject of land reform, and so it is almost impossible to know the details of what has actually happened in that country, short of learning Spanish and going there and personally investigating. But reports do come through that the so-called right in El Salvador, whatever that may mean, denounces land reform as a violation of free enterprise and blames it and the related nationalization of banks for destroying the economy of the country and fomenting the unrest on which the communists thrive. In view of the points I have established theoretically, I think that their claims should be thoroughly investigated. I think the likelihood that they are correct is overwhelming. And if they are, our government's policy of making land reform a precondition of American aid would be ironic in the extreme. It would mean that before we are willing to aid El Salvador in a defense against communism, we require that its government violate private property rights on a massive scale and create the chaos which the communists need in order to thrive. Later, after the communists win their revolution, which appears to be the likely outcome, the State Department can issue a white paper explaining why their victory was inevitable. In concluding the subject of land reform, I must mention the fact that the American military occupation under General MacArthur forced the policy on Japan after World War II. Large landowners were forced to sell at prices set by the government, and rapid inflation of the currency quickly made their compensation almost valueless. On the basis of all that I have said up to now, it should be clear that I must condemn this policy, even though it is almost universally regarded as having been a major element in establishing American democracy in place of Japanese feudalism. The only appropriate policy, the only policy consistent with the American principle of individual rights, would have been the establishment of a free market in land, that is, the abolition of all aspects of entail legislation and any elements of legal privilege for the large landowners, but not their expropriation. The effect of land reform in Japan has been to hold down the efficiency of Japanese agriculture and to impose a drain on the rest of the Japanese economy, which is obliged to subsidize the inefficient agricultural sector. In Japan today, land holdings are typically no more than 2 or 3 acres and are operated on a part-time basis by people whose main employment is in industry. This highly inefficient arrangement has not resulted in a catastrophe, because at the time it was instituted, Japan was already a highly industrialized nation, able to import most of its food supplies, and over the years it has greatly increased its ability to import food. The effect of land reform in Japan has thus worked out to be equivalent to that of the destruction of agriculture within the territory of a city. It hasn't been so serious because the role of agriculture was relatively small to begin with, and the losses inflicted on it could easily be made good by a rapidly expanding industrial economy through imports. Japan's food supply would be affected far more seriously by land reform in the United States, Canada, Australia, Brazil, or Argentina than by land reform in Japan, because these are the places on which it actually depends for its food supply. Incidentally, Japan's post-war industrial success is the result of following policies with respect to industry that are the opposite of land reform. Property rights in industry have been respected far more highly in Japan than in the United States, as manifested in sharply lower rates of taxation on profits and interest, and as a result in much higher rates of saving, capital accumulation, and economic progress. Furthermore, since the early post-war years, inflation in Japan has been at a significantly lower rate than in the United States. This is also very important in regard to a country's real rate of taxation of profits and interest, since the greater the rate of inflation, the higher are the artificially inflated profit and interest incomes subject to taxation. So much for the discussion of land reform. Now, a further matter I want to discuss in connection with private property is its implications for the extent of the territorial sovereignty of countries. In history books and discussions of current events, we frequently encounter such statements as, "The motive of country A in going to war with country B was to obtain the latter's coal mines, or steel industry, or whatever." It is taken as virtually self-evident in these discussions that the citizens of a country gain to the extent that their country's territory is enlarged to contain more natural resources and more branches of industry. Nevertheless, our discussion of the general benefits derived from privately owned means of production in a division of labor society shows that this belief is false. We have seen that an individual does not need to own property in order to benefit from it, so long as he is able to buy its products. By the same token, a country does not require sovereignty over a territory for its citizens to be able to obtain all the economic benefits that that territory can offer. For the most part, they obtain those benefits merely by being able to buy the products of that territory. For example, in order for the citizens of Germany to obtain the economic benefits of the natural resources and industries of Alsace-Lorraine, it is absolutely unnecessary that Germany own Alsace-Lorraine or that fellow German nationals own those resources and industries. An individual German who wants something from that region obtains it by buying it. What difference can it make to him whether the producers of that good salute the French or the German flag, or the Burgundian flag, whether they sing the Marseillaise or Deutschland über alles? How are the goods he buys, or their price, affected by such matters? The only rational political economic interest that the citizens of a country have in the territory of other countries is that that territory be under a free government, and that, of course, is their first and foremost real interest with regard to the territory of their own country as well. If a country is under a free government, that is, a government that is limited to defending the individuals in its territory from the initiation of force, then its territory offers to the entire world every economic benefit that can possibly be derived from it. Not only can all the world buy its products, but all the world is free to try to improve the development of its natural resources and industries. Because in such a country, foreigners have the same right as nationals to own land, invest capital, and to live and work. Thus, the products available for purchase from such a country are as good and as inexpensive as it is possible for them to be in the circumstances. Anyone who sees a way to make them still better or cheaper is free to go ahead and do so. There is thus absolutely no rational economic basis for any country to seek sovereignty over the territory of any other country that has a free government. For its citizens already derive all the economic benefits they could derive if it were under the sovereignty of their own government. Indeed, if their own government is less free than that of the foreign country under consideration, they would derive less benefit from the foreign country's territory if it were brought under the sovereignty of their own government. As an extreme example, the citizens of Soviet Russia would die of starvation if the territory of the United States came to be under the sovereignty of the Soviet Union. The major implication of this discussion is that in a world made up of free countries, there would be absolutely no rational economic basis for war or imperialism. It would make no difference to anyone what the extent of the territory controlled by his own government was. He would be perfectly free to buy and sell anywhere, to invest anywhere, and to live and work anywhere, irrespective of whose flag flew over that territory. Thus, there could be no rational economic motive for the citizens of any country to seek an extension of their own country's sovereignty, and thus no grounds for war. A rational economic motive for interfering with the sovereignty of other countries arises only in degree that they lack free governments. And then the only rational economic purpose of such interference is to establish a free government. For example, if there is an area rich in low-cost natural resources, but anyone who tries to develop them has his property confiscated and runs the risk of being murdered, then the rest of the world is deprived of the benefit of those resources. Its interests would be served by the establishment of a free government in that area. The British Empire in the 19th century, by and large, represented the establishment of a relatively free government in many areas of the world that would otherwise have remained in a state of anarchy or despotism. Its existence served to open vast territories to economic development that benefited the entire world. It was not only the citizens of Great Britain who gained by the entry of those territories into the world market, but people everywhere. Every buyer of rubber and tin everywhere in the world benefited from the fact that British rule made possible the development of the Malayan rubber plantations and tin mines, and thus a more abundant and less expensive supply of rubber and tin. Every buyer of cotton, flax, and linen, jute, and all the other products of India benefited from the fact that British rule made possible the development of the production of these things in India. This is not to excuse the racist attitudes that were often displayed by the British in their colonies, but it is to acknowledge the genuinely great accomplishments that their empire represented. The various local regimes that have succeeded it have, for the most part, not operated nearly so well, neither from the point of view of the economic interests of the rest of the world, nor from the point of view of the freedom and prosperity of their own populations. A hope for the future is that someday, if enlightened economic ideas regain their influence in the West, they may also become influential elsewhere and be implemented by the native populations themselves. As part of this discussion, I must point out that foreign development and export of a country's natural resources in no way represents a loss to the native population of that country. It is not economic exploitation in any evil or improper sense. For example, the fact that the British developed the tin mines of Malaya and then exported the tin throughout the world was no more a loss to the Malayan population than it is a loss to the people of Minnesota that the iron deposits of their state have been developed by businessmen from New York and Chicago, who in turn export the iron throughout the rest of the country and the world. The belief that such activity does represent exploitation is based on the premise that natural resources are rightfully the collective property of the population of the territory in which they are found. Those who hold this view then observe that only the private owners are paid for the extraction of the resources sent abroad, and that much of the money received for the resources may also be sent abroad. On this basis, they conclude that a territory's property is being taken from it without compensation. Nevertheless, natural resources do not properly belong to the people of a territory collectively, but to specific private individuals and companies. For all the reasons I have shown, private ownership is the key to the development of natural resources, and thus to the general population of the world being able to benefit from their existence. Collective ownership means non-development, or at best, inefficient development, and therefore less general benefit from the existence of natural resources. The inefficiencies of collective ownership operate to prevent much or any gain from being realized by collectivization, at least where the collectivized resource deposits must compete with privately owned deposits whose operators are not prevented from expanding their activities. But whatever the citizens of a given area might gain by the collective ownership of a natural resource in their territory, it is always at the expense of the greater losses of others. There is not only the loss of the private owners whose property is collectivized, there is also the loss of the buyers of the resource and its products, for whom the resource is made less abundant and more expensive. And finally, in degree that collective ownership is carried further, any gains associated with it from the point of view of the citizens of any particular territory are lost back in the form of less abundant supplies and higher prices for everything that depends on natural resources found in all other territories where collective ownership exists. Thus, whatever the citizens of Malaya or Minnesota might gain by collectivizing the tin or iron mines of their country or state would not only be more than offset by the losses of others, but would also be offset by less abundant supplies and higher prices of all things consumed by Malayans or Minnesotans, insofar as those things were also produced under conditions of collective ownership of the natural resources involved. The consequence of collective ownership of natural resources applied as a general principle is that everything would be far more expensive to everyone, and many of the collectivized resource deposits would not even be able to operate at all for a lack of other resources or of products made from those resources. For example, some of the collectivized tin mines could be made inoperable by the inefficiencies of collectivized iron mines, which resulted in the cost of tin mining equipment being made too high. The inefficiencies of both iron and tin mining would operate to reduce the availability of equipment for extracting oil and coal. The inefficiencies in the production of these latter would also work against the production of iron and tin, and so on. It should be realized that, in fact, the foreign development and export of natural resources is a source of gain not only to the general population of the world through bringing about a more abundant and less expensive supply of the resource, but also to the general population of the specific territory in which the resource is found. For it means foreign investment in the area, and thus a greater demand for local labor, and therefore higher local wage rates. It also means the ability of the local population to obtain imports from other countries, because to the extent that it produces products that are exported, its wages are paid with funds earned abroad. And these imports include not only products made from natural resources found throughout the rest of the world, but also products of modern technology that it would otherwise be impossible to obtain in the area. If the local population would like to see foreign investors spend locally a greater proportion of the revenues they earn abroad by exporting natural resources from the area, then the basic thing they must do is fully respect the rights of foreign investors. Foreign investors will spend more locally if they judge that investment in the area is profitable. They will spend more locally in the sense of increasing their investments. But in order for them to increase their investments, they must have the security of knowing that they can withdraw their funds whenever they wish. It is one thing for an investor living in London or New York to be willing to invest his money in Malaya or Minnesota. It is a different thing to require, in effect, that he live there in order to be able to enjoy the profits from his investment. Yet that is the effect of laws that interfere with the remission of dividends and interest abroad. Outsiders will readily invest in an area that offers the prospect of high profits if they know that they are free to enjoy their profits elsewhere and free to withdraw their funds to take advantage of the possibility of still more profitable opportunities elsewhere. To the extent that they possess free governments, backward countries naturally offer a very powerful attraction for outside investors, and that is the very fact of their low wages. Because, to the extent that foreign investment can raise the productivity of labor in the backward countries toward the level at which it exists in the more advanced countries, those low wages represent lower costs of production and thus higher profits in comparison with investment in the more advanced countries. If foreign investors judge that their investments are secure in such a country, it is able to attract a veritable flood of investments, and the high profits earned on those investments are plowed back to create still more local investment. On just this basis, we can observe spectacular rates of economic progress today in such countries as Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore. The rapid progress of Japan, too, is explainable on the basis of the constant reinvestment of high profits earned on the basis of relatively low wages. The effect of all this additional investment, of course, is to raise local wage rates more and more, and to bring the economy and general standard of living of the area to a higher and higher level, until what began as a backward country is transformed into a fully modern country with a very high standard of living. This has already happened in Japan, where wages, though still considerably lower than in the United States, are now among the highest in the world. And, of course, it should be realized that as local wages rise, the ability of the local population to save and invest on its own increases, and thus that more and more businessmen can come from the ranks of the local population. In other words, the conduct of local business automatically comes to include a growing proportion of natives. And some of the native businessmen, of course, can themselves choose to operate internationally. In this and all other respects, the local area comes to be fully integrated into the world economy. Thus, if they possessed free governments, many of the backward countries of the world could be very rapidly developed into fully modern countries. What helps to prevent this is their belief that foreign investors are their enemies and should be expropriated. This stops foreign investment and perpetuates the backwardness of these countries. To avoid possible misunderstanding, I do not mean to imply here that the problems of the backward countries are purely political. More fundamentally, they are philosophical and cultural. Their political problems are largely a manifestation of irrational ideas and attitudes in these other areas. And in many cases, the influence of irrational ideas is so great that even the establishment of a free government would not be able to produce very dramatic results. The establishment of a free government achieves dramatic results only in a culture which, among other things, is prepared to accept science and technology and individual self-responsibility. These, in turn, rest on the acceptance of causality, the efficacy of the human mind, and human free will. Only on such a foundation is it possible to develop such vital economic attitudes as improvement is possible, hard work pays, and it's the responsibility of the individual to save. I want to point out a peculiar consequence of the collectivist view of natural resources, which I think you may find of interest. I call it the Argentine delusion. A couple of years ago, my wife and I were invited to Buenos Aires for the purpose of my giving some lectures. While there, I became aware of what seemed to be a common attitude. One businessman expressed it as, "We are a rich country, but a poor people." A banker expressed it as, "We have tremendous wealth. None of our economic problems are real or fundamental. They're just psychological." What these people were referring to is the fact that Argentina is a country of about 1 million square miles in territory, lying in a latitude comparable to that of the United States, and full of rich farmland and all kinds of mineral deposits. These people believed that somehow this automatically made Argentina rich, and that nothing could change that fact. Not high taxes, not destructive labor unions, not protectionism, to the point where a new low-priced Ford sold for about $25,000, nor even hyperinflation. These comments were all made to me in Buenos Aires, where these people lived and worked. I remember thinking at the time how they would have felt if Buenos Aires had been a separate country, politically independent of the rest of Argentina. In that case, they would not have thought of counting the alleged wealth of Argentina as theirs in any sense. Yet if Buenos Aires and the rest of Argentina maintained mutual free trade and allowed each other's citizens to come and go as they wished, and to do business on the same terms as before, the real benefit of all those resources to the citizens of Buenos Aires would have been exactly the same. The truth is that Argentina's natural resources do not make her a rich country. They might make some individual Argentines or foreigners rich, that is, whoever their private owners were, but the only ways in which they could make the average Argentine rich would be insofar as their development increased the demand for Argentine labor and so raised Argentine wage rates, and insofar as their extraction increased the supply and lowered the price of various products. This latter benefit, of course, would be enjoyed not only by the citizens of Argentina, but by all buyers of the products concerned, no matter what their nationality. Unfortunately, the policies of the Argentine government prevent both domestic capital accumulation and foreign investment, and thus make the extensive development of Argentina's natural resources impossible. Thus, in the delusion that they are somehow automatically rich, irrespective of the policies that their government follows, the Argentine people are likely to remain relatively poor. Given their mentality, the natural resources of their country are actually a liability to them. For in being regarded as an automatic guarantee of wealth, no matter what their government does, the resources make it that much easier for them to allow the bad policies to go on. Buenos Aires and the other cities of Argentina might actually be more prosperous as independent city-states devoid of all territorial sovereignty over natural resources than as part of Argentina, with all of its alleged wealth. In such a case, they might realize that the only thing they had to rely on was the industry of their people, and that everything they received had to be paid for, even if it came from the surrounding territory. The loss of the delusion of automatic wealth because of territorial sovereignty over natural resources might make them buckle down and establish conditions in which people would be more highly motivated to work and save than is now the case. If that were so, then they could obtain whatever natural resources and agricultural products they required, either from the surrounding territories or from anywhere else in the world that offered better terms. Then, perhaps, with a new mentality that recognized the value of free government, they might look about and see the opportunities awaiting if the neighboring countryside were opened up to free development. They might then extend their sovereignty into the neighboring countryside and in effect, reconstitute Argentina on the basis of a free government. Then and only then, under a free government with full respect for private property rights, would the resources of Argentina finally realize their potential as a source of prosperity, both to the average Argentine and to everyone else in the world as well. The point here, of course, is not to urge the actual breakup of Argentina, even temporarily, but only to highlight the need to shatter the collectivist delusion of automatic wealth through sovereignty over natural resources and the need to establish free government. I want to summarize today's lecture thus far, and then go on to a new topic. What I have shown is how, in a division of labor capitalist society, the stain of violent appropriations of land in the past is steadily washed away through the operation of market processes. In close connection with this, I have also shown why land reform represents a fresh act of injustice and is economically disruptive and against the interests not merely of existing landowners, but also of everyone else in the long run, for it seeks to perpetuate agricultural inefficiency and thus to keep down the real income of all buyers of agricultural products. By the same token, it operates to prevent the development of the division of labor in the countries in which it exists by making impossible the release of labor for industry and commerce. Whatever legitimate objectives the advocates of land reform might have would be achieved by the establishment of a free market in land, not land reform. I showed that just as it is not necessary for people to own the means of production to get the benefit of them, so long as they are free to buy the products of those means of production, so it is not necessary for a country to have sovereignty over any foreign territory, so long as its citizens are free to purchase the products of that territory. Indeed, I showed that the only legitimate interest of the citizens of one country in the territory of another is that it have a free government, and thus that its land and natural resources be open to development by all, and their benefit purchasable by all. In that way, the whole rest of the world derives the maximum possible benefit from the territory of a country, without having to have the least degree of sovereignty over it. In connection with this discussion, I refuted the doctrine that foreign development and export of natural resources is an exploitation of the people of a country, and showed, on the contrary, that it is the basis of a higher demand for their labor and for the economic development of their country. I showed how the freedom of foreign investment would operate to rapidly modernize many backward countries and raise their standard of living, if only the governments of those countries would allow investors to profit from the existence of the prevailing low wages in those countries. I now turn to the influence of the division of labor on the institution of economic inequality. This is an influence which is almost totally ignored in popular discussions of the subject. The views which are typically expressed concerning economic inequality would be plausible only if they referred to a non-division of labor, pre-capitalist society. Typically, people take for granted the validity of such statements as, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and the more fundamental proposition that one man's gain is another man's loss. At any rate, only rarely do they challenge the truth of these propositions. Now, these propositions rest on the assumption that the total wealth that exists in the world, or which can be produced, is a fixed, static sum. Only on that assumption could it be true that one person's gain necessarily implied an equivalent loss by others. Only then could it be true that an increase in the wealth of the rich necessarily implied a corresponding decrease in the wealth of the poor. Yet this assumption is clearly incorrect in the context of a division of labor society. In such a society, a growing body of technological knowledge, manifested in ever-improved tools and machines, and in man's growing power over the physical world in which he lives, makes possible a continuous increase in the sum total of what is produced. Where the total of what can be produced expands, it is simply false to conclude that one man's gain implies another man's loss, or that the greater wealth of the rich implies the greater poverty of the poor. Indeed, these propositions are false even in the context of a non-division of labor society, so long as conditions are present that make possible an increase in the total of what is produced. To take the simplest and most obvious kind of case, imagine that initially Robinson Crusoe and Friday are each gathering 10 coconuts a day on their desert island. And now Crusoe, say, devises a pole that enables him to bring down coconuts from higher up in the trees, so that from now on he is able to gather 20 coconuts a day. Crusoe's gain is certainly not Friday's loss. In fact, his gain is almost certain to be followed by Friday's emulating his new method, and thus being able to gather more coconuts of his own. In other words, Crusoe's gain will bring about a gain to Friday as well. This little example, by the way, illustrates the absurdity of viewing matters in terms of a distribution of wealth and income, and then complaining that the distribution is automatically unfair insofar as it is unequal. When Crusoe increases his production from 10 coconuts a day to 20 coconuts a day, his share of the national income of his island rises from one-half to two-thirds. Crusoe's receiving half of the island's income is just, according to the egalitarians, but his receiving two-thirds is inherently unjust, according to them. Yet Crusoe's larger share is nothing but the result of his increasing his production. Please observe, first of all, that there is no actual distribution of wealth or income here, that a distribution exists only in a purely mathematical sense. What actually exists is separate individuals producing different amounts. When we add up their separate productions, we reach a sum and can mathematically express each individual's production as a percentage of the total, and in this sense speak of a distribution of wealth and income. But there is no actual distribution in the sense of someone ladling out more to Crusoe and less to Friday. By the same token, there is no one who makes Crusoe overprivileged and Friday underprivileged. What each has is the result of what each produces. It follows from this discussion that what egalitarianism implies is that it is unjust for one person to produce more than another, even if that other not only does not lose, but in fact gains as a result of it. Egalitarianism rests on a mentality that actually ignores production and the ability to increase it. In the manner of a backward child, it assumes that everything comes miraculously from a kind of father who distributes it this way or that way, fairly if equally, unfairly if unequally. It wants the government to compel the father to distribute wealth equally, or itself to become the father and distribute it equally. Now, it cannot be stressed too strongly that in a division of labor society, one person's gain is not only not other people's loss, but other people's gain. The most fundamental and important instance of this kind is the building of great business fortunes. Both in their origin and in their disposition, these fortunes are a source of gains to everyone who participates in the economic system. They originate in the earning of a high rate of profit on capital, almost all of which is constantly reinvested, so that the high rate of profit rapidly compounds. The fortunes emerge as the sum of the reinvestments of these compound profits over a period of many years. As I have already shown, to earn a high rate of profit requires that one be a leader in the introduction of new and better products or improved methods of producing existing products. One can also be a leader in meeting changes in consumer demand, inaugurated for the most part by economic progress. And because competitors adopt innovations as fast as they can and try wherever possible to supersede them, with the result that the profits from any given innovation tend steadily to disappear and be replaced by losses, the earning of a high rate of profit over a long period of time requires that one repeatedly be a leader in innovation. Thus, the high profits out of which great fortunes are accumulated are the result of repeatedly introducing improvements in production. These improvements, of course, represent better and less expensive goods for the general buying public. They thus represent a rise in the real incomes of everyone. Everyone benefits in his capacity as a buyer. This is what I mean when I say that in their origin, business fortunes are a source of gains to all. What I refer to by the gains they represent in their disposition is simply the fact that the fortunes are invested. They represent factories, machines, inventories, and the means of paying wages and salaries. Here they are again the base of additional goods coming to market, and thus of gains to all buyers. In addition, they provide greater financial means for people to be buyers, insofar as they are the source of a greater demand for labor, and thus of additional payments of wages and salaries. There are basically two elements determining the distribution of wealth, in the sense of who owns what percentage of the total capital invested in the society. These are the relative amounts of income people earn and the relative degrees in which they save and invest those incomes. In the case of large accumulations of wealth, the relative amount of income one earns reflects the relative rate of profit one earns on one's capital. Basically, those individuals have the greatest accumulated wealth who earn the highest rates of profit and save and invest the greatest percentage of their profits. In both respects, their accumulation of wealth is the measure of their contribution to the well-being of the rest of society. In degree that they earn high rates of profit, they are in the forefront of introducing better products and better methods of production. In degree that they save and invest more, they increase both the spending for capital goods relative to consumers' goods that takes place in the economic system, and wage payments relative to the personal consumption spending of businessmen and other non-wage earners. As I have previously explained, the higher relative spending for capital goods leads to a correspondingly greater concentration on their production, and thus to a more rapidly growing supply of capital goods, which is a critical factor in raising the general productivity of labor. And the increase in wage payments relative to the personal consumption spending of businessmen and other non-wage earners enables wage earners to enjoy a larger proportion of the overall consumption spending that does take place. Thus, in a division of labor, capitalist society, the accumulation of great wealth is the mark of great contribution to the well-being of the rest of the society. This principle is readily confirmed by an examination of the history of great fortunes in the United States. Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford, to take some leading examples, began their careers in industries that were relatively small and backward. They devoted their lives to searching out and implementing all manner of improvements in these industries, on the basis of which they earned very high rates of profit, almost all of which they saved and reinvested. At the end of their lives, the industries in which they worked were enormously improved and expanded, and their wealth was embodied in the means of production of those industries. Each of these individuals increased his own wealth from almost nothing to approximately $1 billion. In the process, the American people obtained the benefit of a large modern steel industry, a large modern oil industry, and a large modern automobile industry, from which they all greatly gained as consumers and as workers. The gains of Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford, and all the other great businessmen, were the gains of everyone who bought their products, or the products of competitors who were forced to meet the standard they set, or whose wages were increased by the additional demand for labor their great savings created. Their wealth represented an enormous net increase in the total wealth of the economic system, and was the source of a correspondingly great increase in the standard of living of the average person. These men were among the greatest producers and capital accumulators of all time, and everyone benefited enormously from their success. Such mutuality of gains is inherent in the very nature of a division of labor capitalist society. It is inherent, first of all, in the fact that in such a society, cooperation is strictly voluntary and takes place almost exclusively by means of exchanges. People enter into exchanges of goods and services only in the expectation of gain. In an exchange, each party gives only in order that he may receive. To ask those with whom one deals to give more, one must oneself give more. Any businessman who wants his customers to give him more sales revenues must give them better goods or services, or equally good but less expensive goods or services. And to do this profitably, he must first improve his ability to produce. By the same token, if he wants to employ more workers, he must pay those workers higher wages than they can obtain elsewhere. Of course, in the same way, any wage earner who wants to receive more must also offer more, either more work or more productive work. But one of the very greatest advantages of a division of labor society is the fact that the improvements introduced by those who are more able increase the productivity of those who are less able. The discoveries of scientists and inventors, and their implementation by businessmen working with the aid of more and more accumulated capital, makes possible a steady increase in the productivity of manual labor. The only contribution which the manual workers have to make to the process is to adapt their skills to the requirements of the new products and new methods of production introduced by the businessmen. If they do this, their work becomes enormously more productive, and they are able, as a result, to receive more real income while actually working less. The mutual gains from exchange and the rise in the productivity and remuneration of the less able because of the innovations and capital accumulation of the more able are two aspects of the process by which one man's gain becomes the gains of others in a division of labor society. A third aspect is the one I refer to in the context of Robinson Crusoe and Friday on their desert island, namely, the emulation of others' success. This aspect is present no less in a division of labor society. It is present in the competitive quest for high profits, which constantly operates to deprive every innovation of its special profitability and to require fresh innovation as the means of maintaining a high rate of profit. It is equally present in the competition of wage earners for higher paying jobs. It is the element that, as I explain in The Government Against the Economy, operates to drive the rate of profit on capital invested toward uniformity in all branches of industry, and the rate of wages for all workers of the same degree of skill and ability toward uniformity in the same labor market. It can be thought of, perhaps, as a further respect in which the more able are responsible for raising the productivity of the less able, since those who innovate can be considered both more able than those who merely follow, and as deserving some credit for the success of those who follow. Yet the followers must make their own decision to act, and what they achieve is theirs. Economic inequality in a division of labor, capitalist society, can thus be understood as resting on an inequality in productive ability that is dynamic in several senses. It is dynamic in one sense in that those of greater ability succeed in raising the productivity and remuneration of those of lesser ability. It is dynamic in a second sense in that at each level of ability it reflects uneven contribution or adaptation to the process of improvement. Finally, it is dynamic in that there are no legal barriers to individuals crossing over from one level of ability to another. To say all this in different words, businessmen and capitalists have greater income and wealth than wage and salary earners, but their innovations and capital accumulation raise the productivity and remuneration of the wage and salary earners. Among businessmen and capitalists, and among each grade of wage and salary earners, there are further inequalities that reflect uneven contribution or adaptation to the process of improvement. That is, there are businessmen and capitalists who earn very high rates of profit because they introduce innovations or adopt them relatively early, and there are others who earn low rates of profit or suffer losses because they lag too far behind in the adoption of innovations. Similarly, there are wage earners who earn relatively high wages because they adapt their skills relatively quickly to the kinds of labor being demanded for the implementation of the improvements introduced by the businessmen and capitalists. And by the same token, there are wage earners who earn relatively low wages because they fail to adapt their skills quickly enough to the process of improvement. Finally, wage earners are always free to cross the line and become businessmen and capitalists, and unsuccessful businessmen and capitalists are always being reduced to the ranks of the wage and salary earners. And of course, there is constant movement up and down between the various grades of wage earners as well. It must be stressed that the foundation of the mutual gains I have described is the division of labor. The division of labor is what raises the productivity of labor and allows it and the total of production to go on rising without limit. It is what creates the possibility of mutually profitable exchanges as an everyday common occurrence, as an almost omnipresent phenomenon. For it both enables every individual to produce vastly more and simultaneously places him in a position in which he must exchange the overwhelmingly greater part of his goods or services for all the things that he himself does not produce and which others produce. The division of labor subsumes the rise in the productivity of the less able achieved by the activities of the more able, and the gains from emulation as well, insofar as emulation takes place within activities which are themselves products of the division of labor, such as the emulation of one steel producer by another, or of one carpenter by another. To sum up our discussion of economic inequality thus far, one man's gain is not another man's loss, where the total of what is produced can be increased. Under such conditions, some can have more and no one need have any less. A division of labor society makes possible a continuous increase in the total of what can be produced. It creates a situation in which one person's gain is not only not other people's loss, but is actually other people's gain. The best illustration of this is the accumulation of business fortunes. This is a process which requires the introduction of repeated improvements in production in order to earn high rates of profit, and the constant reinvestment of those profits, which latter has the effect of creating capital that in turn raises both the productivity of labor and the demand for labor. In these ways, the accumulation of fortunes raises the real wages of the average worker and the real income of everyone in the entire society. The precise mechanism by which a division of labor society makes the gains of one the gains of all consists of a combination of the elements of voluntary exchange, the gains derived by the less able from the activities of the more able, and the process of productive emulation. The economic inequality that exists in a division of labor capitalist society is thus an inequality in which the greater success of some is the cause not of the failure of others, but of their success too. It is an inequality of success and progress, an inequality in which the rich grow richer, in which the poor grow richer, and in which the classification of any given individual as rich or poor is subject to constant change by virtue of his own efforts and abilities. Thank you.